That's what I presume, that most of you are from the IT part. We have divided our talk so that I will present you something about the biological issue of our projects and our previous strategies, how to tackle the challenges in cancer risk and also cancer treatments. Then Hamid, who has now started from the beginning of this year at my group in implementing computer deep learning systems in these analysis, will then continue with the last part of the talk. I will try to be short with this introduction. I'm Arto Mannermaa. I'm currently a professor of personalized medicine and biobanking in the University of Eastern Finland and located in Kuopio and there at the Department of Pathology. We have been running cancer genomics or epigenomics project for couple of decades now. These are something maybe familiar to you, but just to resemble and to help you to remember what are the genes and genomics at first place, the some of the basic things. We have, each of us has about 23,000 genes, meaning that if you write that to Bibles, it will take like something like 800 Bibles. That's only about 2.5% of the whole genome of humans. There's a lot of other DNA there in the genes in all the cells. The genes are all the same with all people, but we have a lot of variation in the DNA that codes for the genes. The same set of genes exist in all tissues and cells, but the way we turn these genes on and off varies, and that makes us different from, example, apes and from each other. We know Mendelian genetic diseases. These mean that these diseases are due to defects in only one gene. About 1,500 of these defects in these of these diseases, the phenotype is known. It's also important to understand that the most vital genes in all the species are quite similar. We have a lot of homology in the genes between the species. Even with the very, very primary species, the vital genes are quite homologous to the same genes in humans. The genes are packed in packages, and they are called chromosomes. The chromosome number is very specific to all species. In humans, normal humans have 23 chromosomes, and you see that there are two pairs of chromosome, each chromosome, and one of them is, of course, from the father and one from the mother. We have two copies of each gene, except in the sex chromosomes X and Y. Well, females have two X chromosomes, and males have only one X chromosome. We know that it's very important that we have the same amount of DNA material in all individuals. In females, the other X chromosome is inactivated totally, so that it's not working at all. The amount of working functional X chromosomal material is the same in males and females. The Y chromosome contains nearly no genes, just a couple of genes. Okay, these variations that I said that we can find about 30 million variations of everybody. They are called nowadays, there's a lot of classes of variation, but the most typical ones are these that are single nucleotide polymorphisms. It means that a single nucleotide in a DNA changes to another one. DNA core is is built on these nucleotide bases, adenine, guanine, thymine, and cytosine. And in some places, the variation just codes places a different base on, for example, from A to T. And that's called a SNP. And that's the forms one of the major classes of human variation, genetic variation. And these, it's not all the regions in the genomic in the genome are not equal. So this it means that we have in a chromosome we have these called LD blocks, and then these recombination hotspots, meaning that during the meiosis, the system where the oocytes and sperm cells are forming, the chromosome break and then join together with another chromosome from another parent. And these are the places where the recombination occurs, and then these are the blocks where the DNA, the genome region, stays together. And it's very important to know that in these we can trace, by using these SNPs, we can trace the diseases, because these if we have a mutation in a gene here and we have a variation here in the same region, we can follow by following the variation, we can follow the inheritance of the disease also. And by studying these, as we have done here in one gene in chromosome 22, we can identify these. These are the variations, the SNPs. They are all called RS and some numbers, and you can find them from the internet. We can identify these LD blocks here by certain methods, and then these recombination hotspots here. And then we can identify when we see that some of these variations are associated with the disease, such as breast cancer, we can try to identify the true biological effect that causes the association to breast cancer there or to any other phenotype. And then for this Mendelian, when we have a Mendelian disease, then we have nearly no place for environmental effects on the disease. If we have the mutation in a gene that causes Mendelian disease, then we will get the disease if we have the mutation. The more... Sorry? Tämä tarkoittaa mendelistinen periytyminen, että siinä on yksi geeni kysymyksessä. It's only disease caused by one gene. And then we call the penetrance is the likelihood of getting the phenotype when we have a mutation in the gene. So if we have a 100% penetrance, then everybody that has the mutation gets the disease. But then when we have the reduced penetrance, we usually have more genes coming to the picture, so that the disease or the phenotype is not caused anymore by one gene, but many genes. And then we can talk about multifactorial diseases, and then we have also many places in the genome that has an effect to get the phenotype. And when we have the multifactorial diseases, then we also have a lot of effect on the environmental issues, such as in diabetes or heart diseases or dementia. There's a lot of many genes behind it, but also many environmental factors. And so we can talk about polygenetic diseases. And then this is like a polygenic disease condition. So we have a lot of genes in different places on the genome that causes the disease, and the environmental and lifestyle issues have a big effect on these. But then these Mendelian diseases, where we have the disease gene, the one gene, we can have other genes that modify the effect, the phase of the phenotype, like how bad, how serious the condition is. So even here, when we talk about Mendelian diseases, we might have modifier genes effects on those. Well, for example, in breast cancer, we have major mutations in major genes, and we have, let's say, I will show you later some data about that, but we might have a mutation in the BRCA gene that causes a 70% risk of getting cancer by age of 70. But if we have a modifier gene there, modifier gene effect, we might have that penetrance even at the age of 50. So it like enhances the risk of getting the cancer or the phenotype. We can divide these gene classes or gene effects on many ways, but here the classical way is to define them as three classes, belonging to three classes. This is the one with very penetrant diseases or mutations, then the middle phase penetrant gene effects, and then the very low effect genes. Or here we talk about variations, these NIPs. So typical for these high penetrant diseases or mutations is that they are very rare. So the frequency is like 0.01 or something like that. Then the middle penetrant genes, they frequency is about 1%. And these variants, common variants that have a very little effect on the risk or on the phenotype, typically under 1.2, so under 20%. These are very common, so we all have these. And we know a lot about these in breast cancer and in all kinds of diseases, but I use breast cancer here as an example because we study it. So basically we have the possibility of having high penetrance mutations. Then we can see these diseases in families, because most of the people that inherit the disease, the mutation, get the phenotype, here the cancer. And then we have these low penetrance mutations that we all have, but we have to have a lot of them to increase the risk so that we will get the phenotype, like the cancer. And I will show examples of these now. We have studied in the Kuopio region and in the Savo region these families with breast and ovarian cancers, and we see that, for example, in this pedigree, here the males are the squares and the circles are women. We see that the black labeled females, they all have cancer, and this has no cancer. This is a normal female, and all these that have cancer have also the mutation in this BRCA2 gene. So we see that it's highly penetrant, and we can use this in clinic also. We can, for example, the daughters of these males, this is a carrier. He's a male, so he has no breast cancer. He can have other kind of cancers, but his daughters might ask, what is my risk of getting cancer? Have I inherited this mutation? And we can find it out very effectively. And then we have identified another gene published in Nature. These are the families from the Savo region. We see that here we have these mutation positive sample or person, and this is a normal female with no mutation of this gene. And the difficulty here is that we don't have sample for everybody. So we just have to be satisfied with the number of samples that we have. But luckily we have these two samples from that pedigree, and also a sample from here and here. Okay, and about the penetrance. This is for the BALB2 gene. The next study, with this slide, I want to show you that in these genes there are a lot of places where the mutation can occur. And this, we gathered all the data from the world, from the patients that have this mutation in the BALB2 gene. And you see this is the gene, and these are the mutations that have been described. And so we know the domains of the structure of the protein here of this gene, and we know what it does, the domain, the role of the function of the domain of the protein, and we know how they affect on the function of the gene. And here we can see that from these kind of studies where we gather most of the PALB2 carriers in the world, we can study the penetrance. And here we can see that by the age of 80, the penetrance is like 45%. So this gene is like not in the middle class of that gene classification, but not the most penetrant class, but maybe in the middle of that. But this is very important, because now when a person comes to your clinic in the hospital and asks, what is my risk of getting cancer? By these studies of this kind, we can say that, okay, this is your future. By the age of 80, you will have a 50-50 chance of getting cancer. And what can you do about it? We can talk about it later. Okay, then about the less penetrant genes, the variant, some examples. What we can do with these is that we try to identify the people, we try to classify the people to groups. We try to identify the people that have the most, the biggest risk of getting cancer. And by these, analyzing these variants, we can already divide the individuals to four groups. For example, in breast here, the lowest 1% of the people with the lowest amount of these risk factors have a risk of 0.25% or 0.25 compared to normal individuals, average individuals, and the highest 1% has a 3.2 times risk compared to normal individuals. So we can already divide people to certain kind of groups. And of course, in the healthcare system, you don't need to screen these people. You need to screen these people to find the cancer cases. Okay, then we have, this is an example of what can we do to understand what is the biological function of these variants. How do they change the effect or the function of the cell? And how do they affect on the life of cancer patient? So here we have, please just concentrate on this graph. This is a graph about survival, breast cancer survival. So here we have presentation of people, breast cancer patients on three groups, depending on how many risk alleles of these variants in the specific gene we have. And you see that the more alleles you have in your normal genome, the poorer survival you have compared to the people that have no risk alleles in their genome. So you can identify these normal variants affecting also to the survival if you get the cancer. And so what we can, other things that we can do with these variations in the genome, we can identify people and their relationships. And this is an Estonian Genome Center paper that they used to principal component analysis on how the Europeans differ themselves. And so you see that here are the Central European populations, and these are the Estonians, and these are the Finns, and these are the Eastern Finns. So we see that there's a lot of homogeneity on Finns, and especially on Eastern Finns. And this comes to the fact that the fins have the biggest linkage, these equilibrium areas, these LD blocks. So because we are the fins, we are the young population, so we have had not a lot of these recombination effects during centuries, and it leads to this kind of homogeneity. And this is an important thing in comparing and thinking about what kind of risk factors we have in each population. This is an effect of a multicenter study. We have this here, an example of two variants from the genome in various populations. Here we have a Helsinki and Kuopio, and you see that in this analysis we are like almost together with all other populations, but here when we take these rare homozygotes from these SNPs, meaning that we have the no of the common alleles in this SNP, we see that the Helsinki Kuopio we had no this kind of individuals in our material, but Helsinki did. So the fins are totally different compared to these other populations. And here also the Kuopio, in another variant, Kuopio behaved totally different from these others. So we know that there are some population-specific matters in these variants that are important for when we estimate breast cancer risk. Okay, I skip that one. And then we can link these risk variants also to amount of the protein, the function of the gene. And here we see, you remember I showed you the more variants the person had, the poorer survival they had. Here this effect can be seen with when we estimate the amount of the amount of the protein level. So the less the protein we have, the poorer the survival of the patients. And the same can be seen in these RNA expression studies. And this is like how we see the and evaluate the amount of the protein expression in the tumors. So we have microscopic slides and we stain them and evaluate the amount of the stained protein. Okay, this come now close to the Hamid's presentation. These are some of the variants from the genome that we have been publishing that causes the risk, the genetic component of the breast cancer risk. And you see that there are quite a lot of them, and they are spread all over the genome. And the combination of these then measures the risk for the genetic component of the risk of cancer. And for our data, we have a lot of parameters there. This, for example, we have followed these people for over 20 years now, so we know how many relapses, how many times the patients have get the new type of cancer, and have they survived, how they have been treated, and so on. And then cancer is said to be, this is just a short subtitle of the presentation, cancer is a genetic disease. So, but we have to differentiate the two types of genetics involved. The first one was how to measure the risk of who gets the cancer. But then the genetic is also behind the tumor cells. When the normal cell turns to a malignant one, there's a lot of mutations occurring. This is a picture of a graph of the chromosomes from a cancer gene. You know, you see that there are a lot of changes in the chromosomes, and we should have only two copies of each of them. So there's a lot of going on in the cancer cell, and when we talk about breast cancer, we see that this is an estimated number of breast cancers, and here in males, estimated number of prostate cancers. They are rising, The other cancers, well, they are about at the same level. Maybe some are rising still. But one of the reasons of this is that we tend to overdiagnose these most common cancers. And we need some tools to be more specific when diagnosing these. And here's what I think that genomics has a big role in the future. How to be more specific here? Also, we see that the survival effect is very good. So almost 80-90% of the people that have breast cancer are alive in 5 years. But in 20 years, almost 50% of them have died for breast cancer. So we have a lot of things to research also in the malignant cells, not to identify the people at risk, but also understand how to treat these cancers. So there are like two types of questions or challenges that we need genetics and genomics. And the mutations can occur in the cancer gene at various level. We can have genomic mutations, chromosomal mutations, all kinds of gene-level mutations, then epigenetic mutations, and so on. And finally, our material. So we have collected these samples during 1990 to 1995. We have 500 breast cancers and benign cancers. And sorry, this should be controls, and 1,500 benign cases. And then we have nutritional data. We have all kinds of sample material, and we have mammographic images, so we can add to the. We can start now to use genomic data to combine with mammographic images to be more precise in diagnosing. Just this week, we will have our first results on the metabolomic studies of these, so we will incorporate the proteomic data with the genomic data and with the environmental and nutritional data, and we also have these cancer families identified. Okay, I will stop here because I have used a lot of time, I think. This is just an example of then. Okay, please continue.
Thank you very much.
I will take this.
Is it okay in my? Noise. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Arthur, for your presentation. I'm Hamid Behravan. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Eastern Finland. It's my pleasure to be here and give a presentation to you. I will be talking about application of machine learning in cancer research and how you can apply it in cancer research. Well, I'm a computer scientist. I know about mathematics. I know about algorithms, but I don't know that much about biology. So if you have a biology background, I apologize. I try to make some simplifications. I think every talk about the genomics and cancer research is about the scale of the data. And as you may know, our genome has around 25,000 genes, and that consists of 3 billion base pairs. This accounts to 100 gigabytes of data and approximately around 100,000 of images. The first human DNA sequencing was done in 2003, and the cost was $100 billion. And with the advent of new technology, over recent years, the cost of human DNA sequencing has dropped tremendously to around $1,000 in these years. And it's quite exciting because you get sick, you can sequence your DNA quite inexpensively. But the problem is that we are getting more and more data, and it is estimated that by 2025, the computing resources for analyzing, for handling the genomic data will exceed those of YouTube and Twitter. So the question is how we can analyze such huge amount of data. And now enter to the area of machine learning, how we can apply it in cancer research and analyze such huge amount of data. And I start with clustering. How many of you have already done machine learning? Okay, quite many of you, so you know about clustering. Clustering is about grouping data into similar, grouping the data that are similar together. As you can see here, we have four clusters. Each color represents one cluster. And how we can apply clustering in cancer research. Here we had some data, some SNPs data, and our goal was to find out if we can find subpopulations in this data that we have. And we projected them from high-dimensional data into two-dimension, and we saw some structures, some clusters in our data. And when we colored them based on their region, based on their subpopulation, which is here is Kopi and Oulu, we saw that their SNPs are quite different. Not that very distinct, but they show some clusters. And another interesting problem in cancer research, as I said, is the dimension of the data. And often in cancer research, we are giving a very high dimensional data and we want to analyze this high dimensional data. But even this data is computationally expensive for computers, and also for machine learning problems. Machine learning algorithms, they do not like high dimensional data because of the overfitting problem. For example, here I'm showing a snapshot of our data. Each column represents SNPs, and each row represents the samples. And we wanted to find out those SNPs, those columns here, that are associated with the person with the samples, breast cancer, which SNPs are more associated with the breast cancer, which one gives more prediction of the breast cancer. And to find this association between features and some targets, for example, whether a person has a cancer, we can, for example, measure the dependency between a target, for example, whether the person has cancer, and all the features that we have in here, SNPs. And we rank these features, and we get the scores, and we select those scores that have the higher values. But if we rely on the linear relationship between the variables, for example, here, one axis is showing one variable, and the y-axis is showing our target. If we rely only on the linear relationship, we are not going to capture the unlinear relationships that may exist within our data. For example, here we are showing, it is showing the Pearson correlation coefficient, which is a linear operator. it shows positive one, negative one for perfect linear relationship, and it goes down for some when data is getting more noisy, it reduces its value. But it's outputting zero, and zero means that there is no dependency between target and variable, but there is dependency. You can see there is some kind of relationship. So we can't only rely on the linear method. We need some intelligent methods, some methods from the machine learning to do feature selection for us. Here I have listed three broad categories of feature selection methods. Filter method, that is based on statistical tests. we rank features based on their statistics, such as chi-square test, and then we select those features that have the highest rank. It is fast but less accurate, and it does not consider the relationship that exists within the variables. And then we move to the machine learning stuff, this wrapper method. It combines classifier from machine learning with some searching algorithm to find good features for us. For example, it selects one feature, report the cancer prediction accuracy, and then greedily add another feature and look at the prediction accuracy. Does it increase it or not? If it increases, it keeps the feature and add another feature. If it doesn't, it discards it and add the next feature. It's more specific, but it's very time-consuming, computationally expensive. And then we moved to the more recent method, embedded method, that tries to get benefits from both filter and wrapper methods. In an example, I'll explain you how embedded feature selection works. For example, if you have a linear model for modeling our data, during the training, we want to find those weights. It's the training process, if you are familiar with the machine learning. And then those features that are important will get more importance during the training. So the feature selection has been embedded into training process. It's more faster than wrapper method. But when we applied these methods on our problem, we had some SNPs that I showed some snapshot of it. These methods quite reported different important features for us. Although they were reporting some common, this color shows there are some common SNPs, but most of the time they were reporting different SNPs. And it raised the questions for us that are these methods dependent on the data selection? Can we make the methods independent of the data? For example, if we select subset of the data, do we get the same SNPs? And also, is it possible to get benefits from all of these methods, not only select one? For tackling changes within the data, for example, adding noise to the data, we did some random subsampling of our training data. From our training data, we find important features. We randomly selected some subsets from our training set. We repeated it, and we select important features from each subset. And then we select those features that have been repeatedly selected as as important features in this random process. And then we can also apply it on feature also, do subsampling on the features also, and then use some majority vote to find the final selected features. And then on the top of this this random selection, if you imagine that this is our whole data, we divided it into two parts. The bigger parts was used for feature selection, and this part was used later as the validation set on seen data for doing some prediction. And then we further splitted this part into k different folds. You may ask why it's a normal cross-validation in machine learning, if you are familiar. We wanted to change the data each time to get to see if the RS variants, these SNPs, differ or not. So we repeated, we find the features, the important features from the green part, and use this red part as a intermediate for prediction and tuning our algorithms, because algorithms have some parameters, we need to tune them for the best accuracy. So keep this part was used for this tuning and prediction, and we repeat for all the parts, we scan it all the section each time. One part was used for prediction and another part was used for feature selection, and then for each part reports different feature scores. we use some score fusion, such as mean operator, to combine these different scores and rank them and select important features. And it was for tackling the changes within the data. And for using the knowledge of all methods, we applied some fusion stuff. It's the fusion at feature level. If you assume that each of these circles is one method, for the union, we used the union of all the features that the method has been reported as important. We just use all of them. For the pairwise intersection, we use the features that the systems mutually have detected as important, as the picture shows. And the, for the intersection, we use the features that all the methods has ranked as has labeled as important features. This was the intersection. And then, before going to the results, our goal was selecting first good important, selecting good features, and then apply it to a cancer prediction system. So we embedded to the cancer prediction system according to this block diagram. And here are the results. We used the union of the features for doing cancer prediction. The blue bar shows the classification accuracy, how many times we are correctly predicting whether a person has a cancer or not. This red bar shows another metric that is equal error rate. We wanted to see if the metrics follows each other. This one, the lower the better. This one, the higher the better. And we saw that as we increased the number of features that the union method is getting to us, we get better accuracy. But after some number of features that has been selected, the equal error rate is getting worse, and we get some kind of saturation in the classification accuracy. And here, interestingly, it's the SNPs that has been reported by the literature. The literature reported equal error rate around 50%. It means that by random, it's 50% is a really bad number. We had only 51 from the literature in our data, and the classification accuracy around 60%. So the features that have been found by the methods has been a lot better than the features that literature has been reported. And then we tried our second fusion approach, pairwise intersection, and then we are getting best systems at lower number of features. Already it was around between some features between 300 and 400, and now we are getting our best accuracy around 80% at this number of selected features. And then I tried to select the best features, selected feature is 77. I tried to select 77 features randomly 20 times to see if is it a random or. And then our randomly selected features reported equal error rate of 50%, that is expected. 50% means random selection, just random prediction. And then we also tried intersection, and we get the best accuracy here at 60 number of features. And this was from one subpopulation, Copio. And then we tried to use those features that has been reported by Copio and use it for prediction for the OLU. And then we didn't get any good results, and it was 54% classification accuracy. It's like tossing a coin. It is 50%. And and we use our clustering to see what's going on. And we saw that Oulu and Kuopio are clustered somehow differently, although there are some red scores here, but some blue scores here. But on the top, they are clustered differently. So we tried to select important features from the same population as the population that is used for prediction. In here, we use Oulu to detect important features and apply it on the and we used again Oulu for the prediction. Okay, and then we get our classification accuracy increased. So, as Arthur said, SNPs, the people that have cancer are somehow related to their subpopulation. And then in the last experiment, we try to combine both Kuopio and Oulu together and select important features from them, not only from subpopulation. And it was interesting that the Oulu started to increase, so we were able to find some features, some common features between Oulu and Kuopio, from Oulu and Kuopio that reports good classification in both cases. Kuopio is higher than Oulu. But again, if you remember, for Oulu, it was 54%, like tossing a coin, but now we are getting around 65% accuracy. And again, the literature result was here, 55% accuracy. Okay, that was my talk. When you read newspapers or articles in the internet, you think that machine learning is just about advertising or extracting personal information, but it can be used in other areas such as bioinformatics, cancer research, and it's quite exciting that we are at this stage now. Day by day, more data are being available, and analyzing this data takes time, so we need some intelligent methods, such as methods in machine learning, to analyze this data for us. And please, thank you. Ask me questions if you have.
Thank you very much. We are over in time. Maybe we can accept one or two questions. After that, we go outside. We have some coffee and we can continue the discussion. If you have some questions, you have, please. It seems that everybody wants to discuss in a more informal forum. And thank you again for We start collaboration with Kuopio, this group of Arto, and our dream is to use as well this Watson environment, and he will be the person to test with you. I think this area is very, very interesting for us. Thank you, Arto, that you came, and
thank you. And
maybe we have many interesting things in future. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.